On the second day of December 2010 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 15, entitled Description of Mystic Yoga Perfections, text number 17. Nirgune Brahmanimai Dharayan Vishadam Manaha Padamanandamapnoti Yatra kamo vasiyate Nirgune Brahmanimahi Dharayan Vishadam Manaha Padamanandamapnoti Yatra kamo vasiyate. Translation. One who fixes the pure mind in me, in my manifestation as the impersonal Brahman, obtains the greatest happiness, wherein all of his desires are completely fulfilled. Purport. Paramananda, or the greatest happiness, here indicates the greatest material happiness, since it is clearly stated in Srimad Bhagavatam that a devotee has no personal desire or kama. One who has personal desire is certainly within the material world, and on the material platform, the greatest happiness is kama vasayita siddhi, or the perfection of completely obtaining anything that one desires. Om jnana tamarandasya jnanandana shalakaya chakshur unmilitam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. This chapter may be a little puzzling because Krishna is describing ways in which one can perform a kind of devotional service to him by thinking of him in these different ways according to which mystic power you want to attain. The whole title of this chapter, Description of the Mystic Yoga Perfections, and if you recall the first 16 verses, it's all about how one can achieve each of these siddhis through a kind of meditation on Krishna. If you meditate on him as the super soul in every atom and really get into it with that desire to attain anima siddhi, you can become smaller than the smallest. If you meditate him as Narayan, Narayan. The yogi places his mind in my form as Narayan, known as the fourth factor, full of opulence, becomes endowed with my nature and thus obtains the mystic perfection called Vashita. And Vashita is controlling all the opulences, I believe. So each one of these is clearly a material desire, and Krishna is describing here how one can fulfill them through him, through thinking about him. But if you read the end of the chapter, he says, ultimately, only a fool would try to get these mystic powers. Because these mystic powers are blockages. The desire for them is a block to pure devotional service. And then getting them is even more of a block. Because you have them and you can wield them, and each one of them is out of this world. They're all beyond the realm of what would commonly be called possible by the empiricists of today. But they're clearly possible. Krishna is describing them here. And we accept the Bhagavatam as the ultimate evidence. And even Prabhupada would point out that even the scientists, they attain, shadows of these mystic opulences. The desire to fly to any planet. There's one here where you can go anywhere where your mind goes. Wherever your mind goes, that's your body will follow. Who needs airplanes? I just took a 11-hour jugya from Jacksonville to San Diego, on a Kadashi. It would have been a lot easier if I could just think of San Diego and be here. But they have the airplanes. They have the bullet trains. They have the rockets. And as we were coming in, you come into San Diego and you come in real low, and there you can see the buildings and everything. I think, wow, we're going like 400 or 500 miles an hour here. This is, you know, pretty fast. But what is that compared to the speed of the mind? Entering into the earth, you know, like Prabhupada talked about the subways. They build the subways, a great effort, you know, in New York and other cities, you know. You're able to go beneath the earth. So these cities, and what to speak of attaining whatever one can desire. This is also an aspiration. We have the millionaires, we have the multi-billionaires. Why have all that money unless you can get what you desire? Whatever I want, I can get, right? So it's a kind of pseudo imitation of the real siddhi described here in the Bhagavatam and other places in the Vedic literature. At the end of the chapter, as I point out, Krishna says, these are all simply fools want this. At the very end. Learned experts, 33. Learned experts in devotional service state that the mystic perfections of yoga I have mentioned are actually impediments and are a waste of time for one who is practicing the supreme yoga by which one achieves all perfection in life directly from me. So this chapter is presented as a way of, rejecting these. The lesson here is don't be diverted by anything material. Now, if even these great mystic powers, which are practically inconceivable, are as insignificant as sand, according to Krishna and according to the great devotees, then what to speak of the petty things that we can get in the ordinary course of events? Wealth, women, prestige, for a very short time, you know, gaining a lifetime as long as Brahma is also one of these, you know, going to any planet you want. So just see, by comparison, the value of the jewel of devotional service, of prema bhakti. This is the general lesson here of this chapter, is that there's a certain argument. We use it all the time. Our acharyas use it, and even in ordinary discourse, what to speak of, the what to speak of argument. It's a kind of a logical thing. It's used in the passage where King Parikkhit asks this essential question after the rasa dance description. How could it be, or I think it's in the middle of the chapters, how could it be that Krishna, who is the very definer and the upholder and example for Dharma, can violate all these Dharmic principles and dance with other men's wives in the middle of the night? Won't this cause havoc in society when people imitate that and they take this as the right thing to do? Very logical question. And it's described there, Sukadeva answers, he says, what to speak of, he doesn't even answer directly. He says, any great controller is immune to reactions, such as Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva, you know, he drank an ocean of poison. Right? That's why what happened? Did he die? No. You know, if we were just come in contact with that poison by smelling, we would die. Just like Kali is poison. But he drank the whole thing, and what happened? His neck turned blue. That was the reaction. You know? So what to speak of? So Shiva, we know, is a servant of Krishna. Then what to speak of Krishna? How can he be touched by any tinge of sinful reaction? It's like a child playing with his own reflections in the mirror. These are all his energies, his internal energies. Prabhupada was once asked this question, similar question, how could Krishna dance with other men's wives? Says, isn't that immoral? And Prabhupada turned it around and said, no, you're immoral, because your wife also belongs to Krishna. Pretty radical thing, you know, Prabhupada could say so. And it's true. Everything belongs to Krishna. And therefore, everything is meant for his service. You know, to put it bluntly, he gets all the girls. Until we're ready to agree to that, then we're envious of him. That's the bottom line. Not only all the ladies, but everything else enjoyable. And our role, if you will, our natural role, Prabhupada would say constitutional position, is in somehow being part of his enjoyment. I rediscovered a phrase from Jiva Goswami's Sandarbha that's quoted in the second canto. Yeah. One thing about these plane rides, I get to read for hours and hours on my little iPod. So I was reading second canto, I read a purport. And the phrase is, bhajaniya parama purusha sukha svasukha tvam. Bhajaniya parama purusha sukha svasukha tvam, which means that the worshipable Supreme Personality, Krishna, Padma Purusha, Bhajaniya, who's worshipable and who we worship, By his happiness, sukha, one svasukatvam, then one feels happiness himself. This is the essence of bhakti. In other words, by giving Krishna pleasure, we feel pleasure. That's it. It's completely selfless. Because we're part and parcel of Krishna, philosophically we know that we're part and parcel of Krishna. So this paramananda that's mentioned here in this verse, almost sarcastically, it can only be experienced by getting into, you know, by giving Krishna ananda, giving Krishna pleasure. Now, what can we give Krishna? You know, we don't really have anything that he wants except one thing, our devotion. He wants that. He's thirsty for that. He's hungry for that. And if our offerings, say, of bhoga, are saturated with that bhakti, with that devotion, then he eagerly eats. You know, even though it may not be so perfectly prepared. It should be perfectly prepared, if we can. But however it is, if it really has bhakti, then he'll eat it. You know, if it has no bhakti, and however well it may be prepared, he won't touch it. So that the idea is that Krishna is the source of all pleasure. When we try to enjoy separately, either in a gross way, you know, the ordinary way that people do in this Kali Yuga, or in some subtle way, like these yogis try to attain these mystic powers, the ones that come directly from the internal energy of Krishna, or the ones that come from the mode of goodness, there's a whole list here, you know. All of them are, like, amazing. That simply deviates us from our real source of ananda. We're looking in the external energy for pleasure, when ultimately we cannot find it. It's just like a mirage. And one, another thing I was doing was listening to Prabhupada's lecture, and again he lectured on 5.5.1 Bhagavatam. You know, Lord Rishabhdev's teachings. He begins his teachings to his sons and others with this very strong verse. And the ultimate lesson of the verse is that if you want real happiness, then you have to give up sense gratification and perform those activities, which some of which constitute penance or austerities, that will purify your existence so that you can experience Brahma Sukha. Here in this verse, it's under the word Brahma mentioned, right? One who fixes his pure mind in me and my manifestation is the impersonal Brahman obtains the greatest happiness. But it's understood from the context. This is material happiness. The motive is to get this kama avasita siddhi and enjoy whatever there is available in this material world. That's exactly opposite to what Rishabhdev is teaching. What he says is that one in this world, nayam deho deha bhajang niloke, who's taken a human birth, it's not for animals, you know, the cats and dogs, kashtang kaman arate vidbujanghe. No, one should not do this. He should not struggle very hard to attain the sense gratification that's on the same level as the stool-eating hogs. And even this, any sense gratification, whether it's refined, you know, in yogic city, traveling here and there, going to the city of planets, or the actual hogs eating stool in the street, it's all in the same category. And so this is like a word that summarizes it, you know, this Rishabhdev's teaching. Very strong words. First instruction. Wake everybody up, you know. Then what should I do? Tapo divyam putrakai nasattvam shuddhye jismam brahma saukyam tanantam. That one should perform divine or transcendental austerities by which the being, the very nature of ourselves is purified. Shuddhye jasmat, and then brahma saukyam tunam. Then we'll come to the point of enjoying unending happiness. Unending happiness is only available in Krishna consciousness. Everything else has an end, even these cities. And the example, you know, who would we have of great, yogis in our literature who could perform these wonderful activities but were ultimately defeated by the devotees? Well, the most famous is Durvasa Muni. Vishwamitra Muni was also a great yogi. Saubari Muni was a great yogi. All of them ultimately couldn't stop the waves of material desire. You know, Durvasa was known for his anger really running, you know, off. Vishwamitra Muni, for becoming distracted by Shakuntala, or is it, no, Menaka, sorry. And Saubari Muni, what can we say? As you know, poor Saubari Muni. Poor Sabarimuni. I mean, can you imagine? He's meditating underwater in the Yamuna. He's in the Yamuna. Instead of relishing it as Krishna's, you know, he's meditating, you know. Like for years on end, trying to get what? One of these cities. And he sees a fish, a couple of fish copulating, and he can't control his mind. Is that pathetic? I mean, let's be honest. You know, I mean, this. You know, we're doing our little bhajan here. You know, we're two blocks from the beach. We see a lot more, you know, going on than a couple of fish meeting together. And yet, we're hanging in there. You know, Hare Krishna, because of the potency of the holy name. So Sabarimuni didn't have that. He didn't have the devotion, and therefore all his austerities ultimately were directed in this way toward the city of, okay, let me become young and enjoy, right? Didn't he also, I think he became, was able to make his body young, come out and marry somebody. Yeah. But it was a fall down. It was a fall down. He fell away from his spiritual practices. So if we want the real Paramananda, mentioned in this verse, you know, Krishna himself is known as Paramananda. That's a name for Krishna. There's this beautiful verse, let's see if I can remember it. Yeah. But this is a verse from the Padyavali. And there's different sections. And this verse is in the section on the holy names of Krishna, the glories of the holy names. So these are all names. And the name, you know, one of the things about the language is that you can make a name that's really long, and it just contains description of Krishna's qualities or past him. So it says, Bandi Reshishakandamananabadashikanda Liptangahe Vrindadan Nipodandaras Padadamundendivada Shyamala. Now, this is an interesting verse. It's perfectly pertinent to this present verse. So here is he giving these are descriptions of Krishna in Vrindavan. You know, Bandi Resha means, oh, you who are the lord of the Bandi Ravana tree, or, you know, the Bandira tree in the Bandira Avana, which is a forest in Vrindavan. And there's this big tree there that Krishna and his friends would play in, and Balaram would play in. And it's like this huge banyan tree. It's described by the commentators that it's like a mountain that touched the clouds. You know, there's this whole city there of tree. So he's the lord of that tree, you know. Shikanda Manada decorated the peacock feather. Shrikanda Liptanga. Now, Shrikanda, we know what Shrikanda is. That thick yogurt, right? And you put saffron in there, make it nice and yellow. Do you ever have shrikhand with the saffron? So shrikhand simply means this thick, can also mean the thick yellow paste. Here it means the sandalwood paste, fragrant sandalwood paste that Krishna likes to put on himself, or his friends put on, gopis put on. Liptanga he, O Krishna, he's addressing Krishna. Vrindadana Purandara, you are the prince, lordly prince of Vrindavan, the forest of Vrindavan. You have this nice bluish-black complexion, just like a fully blossomed Indivara lotus, known for its delicate bluish color. Then it says, Kalindi Priya. You're very fond of the Kalindi, the Yamuna River, swimming and sporting there. Nanda Nandana, beloved son of Nandan Maharaj. And then Parananda Vindiksha. You are Parananda, Paramananda. You yourself are the personified bliss. And Adavindikshana, you have the beautiful lotus eyes. And these are all little pictures of Krishna. And then Shri Govinda, Mukunda, you don't have to translate. Sundara, beautiful one. Shri Govinda, Mukunda, Sundara. Shri Govinda, Mukunda, Sundara, Paro, Mam Dinam Anandaya. Please fill me with bliss. Mamdin, this wretched soul is trying to, you know, the bliss of devotional service. In other words, please let me have such a taste for your holy names that just by hearing them or chanting them, I will be filled with ecstatic happiness. It's just like, you know, Lord Chaitanya prays like that. Nayanam galado shudarya. When will my eyes, you know, be decorated with tears of love? So this is the real source of our Paramananda. Not meditating on the impersonal Brahman, not trying to attain any mystic power, what to speak of any material happiness. You know, we shouldn't divert. The idea is that by practicing devotional service, you gain certain power. You gain certain power. And if you don't continue with that service and continue to direct, you know, whatever facilities you get toward Krishna, you can deviate that power toward sense gratification. And we've seen it. You know, someone, Prabhupada talks about it. You get, you know, you're able to get some money, you're able to get some influence, physical beauty, you know, speaking power, right, whatever it is. And that's meant to be given back to Krishna, keep the circuit going, and then you get more and more. Prabhupada got so much, you know, he was able to go all over the world and make thousands of devotees and influence thousands of people and write his books, because he kept giving it back. He never misused it for sanskrit. Your pure devotee always does that. So we should be aware of that. This is a lesson in this chapter. Yes, you can meditate on me and get all these powers, but if you go for the powers, you're a fool. You know, you meditate on me and anyabhilashita shunyam. Simply, I'm sorry. I'm getting a Charlie horses. Sometimes happens when I fast. Hare Krishna. So, you know, the idea is that from Krishna, all of these energies will come, and they're meant to be directed back to him. You know, we get some wealth, give it back to Krishna. Give it back to Krishna for his pleasure. Thanks, Rupa. That helps. And don't get deviated by these powers. Now, another aspect here, and I want to also leave a little time for reading about Kali Krishnadas. There's actually not much. Maybe you can tell some stories, you know. But is that behind everything, behind every power, is a person, is Krishna. Now, sometimes he delegates those powers. He empowers the demigods to do things in this world that are, you know, very essential, giving the rain, you know, enabling us to live. All of those, also Krishna's behind them. So this is another thing that, you know, is such an essential part of our philosophy, because the nature of the material mind is to separate the material energy from Krishna, to think it's just working on its own. The nature is working on its own. And that we can manipulate it to our benefit, you know, to manipulate the material energy. But Krishna makes it very clear, Bhagavad Gita, mayadyakshena prakriti suyate, such a that. That it is under my supervision that this prakriti is creating everything and is destroying everything, and everything is going on under Krishna's supervision. So this is another, this chapter is another way of thinking about that and understanding that. No matter what we attain in this world, no matter what opulence, no matter what power, it's all coming from Krishna. And it's meant to be used in his service. That simple idea, that simple understanding, is really the essence of, you know, our practical devotional service. We're given certain facilities, you know, mind, body, words, wealth, life force, prana, artha, dhiya, vacha, voice, you know. And when we make an attempt, an intelligence, to focus on Krishna and learn from the previous acharyas, you know, the art of directing our attention, directing our energies toward Krishna, then we begin to become purified. And the more sincerely we do it and strictly we do it, the quicker we become purified, so that we begin to experience little drops coming from this reservoir of pleasure. That's Krishna. He's the unlimited reservoir of pleasure, Paramananda. And the more that we do that purely, the more that our hearts are filled with this pleasure of bhakti, the ladini shakti works through us, and we can influence others. Because everyone's looking for that. When you look around, you know, when you travel, you know, you see masses of people who aren't devotees. And what is it that they're looking for? You know, you see the families and so forth, and you see the guys and on the phones and everything. And it's all relationships. It's all relationships. Some guy's doing business, you know, he's got a business partner, he's got a relationship with his money, you know, you see all these standard parent relationships, the kids with each other, you know. Even with a pilot, you know, we all have a relationship. We're all like completely dependent on the pilot for like 6 hours, you know, to do the right thing, you know. So that's all it is. That's all that life is just, you know, establishing it. But, you know, and some of the relationships are negative. They become negative in the material. Enmity, envy, hatred, anger, rage, you know, that ends up with war, or this whole terrorist thing, you know. Now you got to go through these machines or get groped. You know, to try to bring the danger of this material world down to nil, which you can never do. You know, this world is a place of danger. Vipadam. You know, so this illusion that somehow we can become completely safe in this material world. It's crazy. Billions and billions of dollars spent. It's all based on fear. Based on fear. Irrational fear, really. So, you know, that's what's going on. You can see this is what's going on in this world. So how do devotees change? What are they trying to do with their own consciousness? Is to relate everything to Krishna. To see Krishna working everywhere. And to use our own energies as far as possible in glorifying Him, serving Him, and if possible, bringing others to the lotus feet of Krishna, enlightenment. That's the task of a devotee, meant to be as and it's varied. It's wonderfully variegated. We have our period before the deities. Some are privileged to go on the altar, directly serve the deities. You know, there's nothing going on for these first four or five hours. You know, but bhajan, hearing and chanting, serving, worshipping, seeing, meditating. You know, filling our hearts and our minds, hopefully, with beautiful sounds and images and understanding about Krishna. And then the rest of the day, you know, putting that knowledge and that feeling, that purity, to work. Uh-oh. A mouse or a rat?
No. Let's offer obeisance to Prabhupada.
Well, at least it's a mouse, not a rat. Hare Krishna. Saucham. Yes, four principles of religion I was reading about also. Tapa, saucham, daya, satyam. Austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. All four are necessary. And they work together. And not enough saucham, then we get unwanted guests. Raj, how are you?
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna.
Have you back
tonight. Nice to be back.
I was really appreciating about three-fourths in the course of your sharing with us, your wisdom, how you brought out something that isn't brought out in this particular purport by Maharaj. Uh-huh. And actually it was more in line, well, you were saying at that point, it was more in line with the previous acharyas. And that is, he's taking it that this Paramananda is automatically Maya. A devotee has no material desire, so this is all material. Mm-hmm. Two things. It's not really the motive that you bring to Krishna consciousness. It's what you do, as you said, about three-fourths. A pure devotee has all these siddhis. If he doesn't misuse them, like you were saying, give them back, use them in the service of the Krishna, then that's perfection.
Right.
But he's just taking I want to stay with the positive.
Okay.
That, you know, this Paramananda doesn't have to simply be part of the whole chapter. In the first verse, it says, when you engage in my devotional service by controlling the mind, controlling the senses, breathing, then these are acquired.
Right.
But what you do with them when they're acquired is the real crux of the matter.
Right.
It doesn't have to be material.
It doesn't have to be material. As you say, the pure devotees get them automatically. You know, you always go back. The essential factor throughout bhakti is the motive. You know, what is your motive? Now, all, you know, generally speaking, we come to Krishna consciousness with impure motives. You know, what is it? Arto jigasarartati. Even jnani is not completely pure. But, you know, you're in trouble, you want to relieve some misery, or you want to get some wealth, or you're curious, that's a big one, what's going on, the Hare Krishnas. Or you're really in search of knowledge. You have some basis of really, you know, coming in with your eyes open, what it's going to be. So we're meant to be, those motives are meant to be purified. You know, I would say that in this chapter, Krishna is talking about some who kind of stay with that motive to get these siddhis. In other words, I'm not sitting chanting here. You know, we're not sitting chanting Hare Krishna, you know, trying to get some mystic siddhi. Do we want to become lighter than the lightest? Who cares? You know? No. I mean, but, you know, and these practices of, you know, meditation, if you're able to come out of that, now a perfect example would be like Dhruva. He definitely went in with a material motive, you know. But he was very fortunate or by Krishna's design, to meet Narada Muni, who was able to dovetail, you know, that material desire and teach him bhakti practices, especially chanting of the holy name, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, and also a rudimentary practice of deity worship he was practicing, seeing the Lord in the heart, you know, coupled with severe austerities, so that he became purified by that. And when he finally saw Krishna, and Krishna appeared to him, he didn't ask him, oh, now can I have my kingdom? Just the opposite. He said, oh, that's like, now I see that that's like a broken jewel and broken glass, excuse me, and that the real jewel is your service and your darshan. So that this was really Prabhupada's plan. What did modern Westerners know about bhakti, you know, about all of this stuff, or what it entails? But he presented it in such an attractive way, centering on, really, the chanting and prasadam. You know, chanting and prasadam, and a little philosophy, so you understand. It's important to have that philosophy, you know, so that you come forward, you can progress. But those two elements, and then gradually introduce the four regs, the and serious austerities, you know, going off to a country all alone to start a center. That's like more serious austerity than sitting in the Himalayas somewhere. Can you imagine? It happened. And every day, you know, more and more surrender is necessary. But the point is that your heart becomes purified. A change in heart. There's a change in heart. That's the second chapter in the second canto. That your heart is meant to change. If it doesn't change, then it means that, you know, it's steel-framed, and we're hanging on to our petty material motivations. Now, one thing I wanted to mention, and I'll entertain your question, is that the desire for liberation. I mean, I know myself. I say, well, all right, I got that one covered. I don't really want to merge into the Brahman effulgence, nor do I, heaven forbid, want to merge into Krishna's body. So I don't want any liberation. But think about this. The essence of the desire for liberation is to be free from all of the difficulties of this world, headed by birth, death, old age, and disease, right? The whole idea is to be free from all misery, to be in this state beyond the modes of nature, beyond the restrictions of material body, you know? It's a negative thing, but it's a big deal, you know, because we face these every day. So every time that we flinch, you know, this unflinching devotion, when we flinch in our devotional service because of some physical, you know, hesitancy, it's uncomfortable, or mental or emotional thing, then that's in that category of you know, wanting liberation. And that's a big blockage in devotional service. It's when we really, you know, are coming to that point and you do it anyway despite the difficulties. Like right now it's getting cold. Right? So someone may say, ah, it's too cold here, even in San Diego. I'm going south. I'm going to go to Brazil. I mean, we had devotees like that. I mean, I don't want to name names. Not here, but when I was in Miami. Even Miami, you know, it's a hurricane season. I'm out of here. You know? Wait a minute. We need to service the deities. You have some position. You know? You're looking for some comfortable place. That's in the category of motivated devotional service. It's sakama, you know, has desires. And the desire is for comfort. So the real, you know, highest devotees, in spite of all the difficulties or threatened difficulties, they are unflinching in their determination to serve Krishna. And in this age, it means, you know, determination to preach Lord Chaitanya's movement. And those are the devotees who we revere as the greatest devotees. And not just, you know, in bygone eras, but even today. You know, great devotees like Indraduna Maharaj and others who are just constantly traveling and giving and, you know, despite all difficulty, that's really pure. That's the sign of real purity. You were going to say, Alex.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol.
Why did Prabhupada choose to use the Jaladuta and the airplanes to travel when he could have used one of the cities?
It's an interesting question. And my understanding is that If he had manifested these, and sometimes he did manifest, you know, he spoke to devotees startlingly, you know, knowing, obviously he knew what they were thinking about, where they were at, and you know, he would always say, you know, Swami, what is your mystic power? What is your, you know, where's your magic? You know, transforming the lechas and yavanas of the West into devotees is much more important than any of these powers. But the idea is this: if he were to use them, then he would attract people on that basis. You would start having people revering him and honoring him and surrendering because they wanted to get those powers. It's out of the realm of pure devotion, you see. It's not necessary. And he evoked devotion and love because he underwent all of that. You know, to get on that Jaladuta and just to really throw up his hands and surrender to Krishna, whatever you want. And then, you know, what happened? Krishna appears to him after two heart attacks. Was it in the rowboat? I think, you know, just come with me. You know, that's much more endearing and much more important for us than if Prabhupada, you know, just thought of coming to America and he was here. You know, and made thousands of disciples just by, you know, forcing, you know, controlling your mind. That if you're forced to be a devotee, you're not really a devotee. This is why this whole question that comes up again and again, and for time immemorial, I see it will. Why does Krishna let us? You know, why didn't he just take us back to Godhead? You know, which ultimately boils down to, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? In other words, why doesn't Krishna just snap his fingers and purify our hearts and take us back? Because that's not love. That's slavery. Then we become automatons, you know? It's like your personal computer does whatever you want, you know? But there's no real reciprocation there. It's just an illusion of reciprocation, isn't it? We want the actual thing of the person desiring to surrender, going through the difficulties, undertaking difficulties that the material energy presents. You know, and in spite of all of that, surrendering to Krishna. Kill me or save me. I'm going to perform this activity. So that's the answer. That these things are very flashy. And you find these so-called yogis and charlatans, they exhibit some petty little, you know, mystic power. Make some dust or something. Thousands of followers. Oh, it must be Bhagavan. It's out of ignorance. You know? They're just, you know, they're the lowest, actually. They get these mystic powers. If they have great mystic powers, like Durvasa, still they have to surrender to the Lord. What was Ambarish's strength? He was just praying to Krishna. But he was able to, you know, to invoke the chakra. He didn't consciously do it, but Krishna came as it destroyed the demon and went after him. You know, so the greatest strength, this was Hiranyakashipu's fear when he saw Prahlad. Prahlad, you know, he could have said, Krishna, please kill him. He said nothing, no such thing. He never said that. He just was surrendered, and Krishna protected him, and ultimately came and gave him. So it's a different, always the devotion is paramount. The sense of helplessness, the sense of being completely dependent on the Lord. As soon as you have one of these powers, you say, this is my power. Now I've got the power, right? I don't need Krishna anymore. I got it. He gave it to me. You see, our strength, the strength in this whole Kali Yuga is that we're so unqualified, we're so desperate, we're so obviously helpless that we can really call out in desperation. That calling out to Krishna through his holy name is the key element. As soon as you got all these powers, you're going to pray. You see? Janmaishaya Shuta Shribir. This is kind of a Shribir in the sense of a power. You can become intoxicated with that. Okay, just one or two words about, if you would, Kali Krishna. And you really only have one or two words. Maybe one of the shortest. Sri Kali Krishna Das, this is a quote from Chaitanya Bhagavan. One will surely attain Sri Chaitanya and Sri Nityananda simply by remembering Kali Krishna Das. That's all you need.
Kali Krishna Das.
That's what the Chaitanya. Completely devoted to Lord Nityananda. Kali Krishna Das knew nothing but the lotus feet of Nittai. He left his body while doing bhajan in Vrindavan. In Braj Leela, he is Labanga, a coward boyfriend of Krishna Balaram.
What's his
name? Labanga? It should be Lavanga, I think. Lavanga. Lavanga is a name, it's a like close. Lavanga Latika. All glories to Kali Krishna Das, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Hare.